Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. There are many theories about what qualities you need to be a good leader, but communication skills appear to be right up there. So why, when it comes to politics, do so many people at the top often seem deficient in this skill set? Pasteur said that chance favours the prepared mind. So what would prepare our leaders for delivering the speech of their lives or conveying policy or just connecting better with voters? And in particular, as the nation gears up for a general election, what would make them improve their communication skills and perhaps win over the next 18 months, the large number of don't knows waiting to be led? To help me shine a spotlight, see what I did there, on this, I am delighted to be joined by Neil Malarkey, actor, writer, comedian, whose new book, In the Moment, will transform your ability to communicate and be a better leader. Hello, Neil.
Hello, thank you for having me. How exciting.
Isn't this exciting? Even more exciting for the people who are listening and won't be able to see you is that you've got incredibly colour-coded bookshelves.
I have, and I know as a psychotherapist, you've wondered, is that a dangerous thing? I did it because somebody else sent me to a website called colourcodeyourbookshelves.com in April 2020. I thought, I can do that. My wife is delighted. Other people get upset because the books may not be fiction, non-fiction. They're all together. Ooh. Not alphabetical. And yeah, I can feel you, the unease with you. And actually, this leads me to perhaps what you're going to talk about, because I think that being a politician, you've got to be organized. But also, I teach improv. And so my book is called In the Moment, and I have it both ways. Because I say sometimes the moment requires you to be prepared and organized. And sometimes improv is a different thing where you need to be all reacting to what's going on. And so I do the Comedy Store Players every Sunday. It's a bit like Whose Line Is It Anyway? But Woodrow Wilson, do you know what's unique about him, Lucy?
Tell me.
He's the only United States president with a PhD in political science. And he said people make the mistake that think government is accountable to Newton, not to Darwin. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners did A-level maths or even further maths or something like that, or physics. But Isaac Newton had three laws of motion, which make us understand how machines work. I press a button here, something moves, something pushes something else, force equals mass time acceleration, and so forth. So Woodrow Wilson was saying government, in fact, I would say any human organization is not a machine, i.e. following Newton's laws. It's accountable to Darwin, which is adapting, evolving, sometimes unintended consequences. And in my book, I try to say to people, there are times you should be like Newton, prepared, straight lines, like a machine. So when you're doing a presentation, have it prepared. Know how long it's going to last. Don't have too many slides. When you're doing a virtual meeting, don't let it wander all over the place. On the other hand, when you're having a conversation with one of your team, you're trying to sell something, you're perhaps trying to create something new, you want to have a bit of the improv, which is using the unexpected, being open to possibilities that you hadn't previously thought of. And those two skills, actually, I hope that politicians have both. They can be properly organized, but also listen and use the skills, I would say, which is, are you accepting what's being said to you rather than just spouting a script, come what may?
Oh, because the polling suggests that voters would prefer their politicians to speak human, to be able to deviate from the prepared script. Yes, we know that there are things that need to be said and there are policies that need to be conveyed, but actually we want you as a politician to communicate in my language, in my world, and to be able to respond on the hoof, which presumably speaks to your improv skills. Why are some people who reach the top, therefore, so poor at doing that? Is it just a lack of confidence? Do they lack the skill? Do they not understand that polarity between being prepared and being spontaneous?
Well, I think they probably have done well to get to the hustings, so where they got a prepared speech. They've got a few questions and answers. But once they get on the television, they've got to be able to say things that really do speak to us. And that's probably why the previous prime minister, I can't remember his name.
There were so many.
Alexander de Pfeffel Johnson, I think his name was. He was very good at appearing to be saying what he really meant. However, behind closed doors, it didn't look like he really had a plan, didn't know what he was doing. So I think we're asking a lot of our politicians to be able to speak and present and be in the moment and get on well with the person in the street, but also be really vividly focused on an agenda, on the strategy, how to get things done. And it, I would say it's no wonder we don't have the best people there, because the best people think, well, why would I be a politician? You just get attacked. And you're in the public eye too much. You don't get paid as much as I might if I were in another job. So I think the communicators we do like are ones who tend to speak their mind, like Jess Phillips, Tom Tugendhat, Rory Stewart. But they're not they're not the leaders. And when they have stood, perhaps they haven't got that that role. Now, what is that? Is that because they haven't done enough behind the scenes? Kind of what we used to call, when I was at Cambridge, called it hacking, which is making sure you get to know people, you schmooze people. So there's a lot of skills involved in getting to the top of the political tree, and they're not necessarily the skills you want from a political leader. That's a curious
paradox. Once you get there, it's fine to climb that tree or greasy pole or whatever analogy we use. But once you're there, what you're saying is you need a slightly different skill set. In addition to your book, they need this, the sort of building block. When you and I work together, for example, you taught me that the key to so much in life is this building block that's very important for improvisation, which is yes, and to be able to go with whatever is in the room, to go with whatever you're presented with. Why is that such an important
thing? Well, the yes and works for us on stage. Yes, I hear what you say, and I move things forward. Improv, people might be surprised to hear. If you've never seen a show, there's a TV show called Whose Line Is It Anyway? Actually, you're trying to make the other person look good. When we do it at the Comedy Store, we're not doing stand-up. We're doing created scenes in the moment. And a yes and is you treat what the other person says as an offer. Yes, I hear what you say, and I move things forward. Using what you said. Now, we never say yes and on the stage, and you would never say it in real life. However, are there moments when you've got to be a bit yes, but perhaps you can't say yes and that's fine, help yourself to the silver, yes and go and do something illegal. On the other hand, there are moments when you want to open things up, yes, and this is how we could do it. And when you're talking to your constituents or listening to the populace, you want a bit of yes and. What do people want? And there are times, actually, I'm going to say, when the political leader says, yes, but that's how the easy answer might present itself. But the reality for the longer term is X. Now, I don't have to set our tax regime, for example. You can't say yes, and you paid less tax. You pay less. Somebody's got to pay more tax. Frankly, with all the stuff that we've got to pay for. And generally, that's the thing, the yes and, I think politicians have to say is, yes, I hear it's difficult. Yes, I hear mortgages are troublesome at the moment. And this is what we're going to do about it. And in the near term, the future term, the medium term, whatever, we will have got inflation under control. Or yes, inflation is difficult now, and we're trying to cope with how do we rebuild our economy. So that's the kind of thing, acknowledging the facts. And that's what politicians are frustrated sometimes when they say no. No, it's not like that. Well, it is. You can't negate my experience. Even if I'm saying you must do this, you can't say, well, I don't agree with where you take it next, but I can say, yes, you are experiencing this right now. I can't pretend that things are easy right now. And we're doing something about it. So if you see what I mean, rather than say what they tend to say, Lucy, is I'm very clear about. And they basically don't answer the question and just say, repeat their mantra, because they don't want to get stuck. They don't want to get caught out. And, you know, people are asking them things so as to catch them out.
But the problem with that is that you end up being stuck, because you've only got your one line. And as you say, you're not really hearing what the other person, the audience or the voter or the person who's got this particular situation that they want you to address. You're not hearing them. You're not paying attention to them, which is why I think in the last couple of, maybe in the last year, the phrase gaslighting, I'm being gaslit, our politicians are gaslighting us, seemed to be said so often, because people really did feel like the communication had stopped. The politicians weren't listening to such an extent that a large number of voters seem to have rather a plague on all your houses view of politicians. So what could, not just obviously using your book in the moment, but what skills could politicians deploy? What techniques do you think, for example, Sunak and Starmer could use at Prime Minister's Questions Time? Prime Minister's Question Time, for example.
At Question Time, I think they've obviously got some script. They know what's going to come up. And when you hear Tony Blair saying how he was terrified of that and he was really well prepped. The moments that the audience like, the audience at home, not the ones who are baying and jeering in the House of Commons, are the ones where you see them thinking in the moment and using their experience for a riposte. It may be a funny one, it may not be. I think we are all turned off by the one where, oh, Keir Starmer, you're a North London lawyer. Well, you know, that's a bit boring. It's not addressing the facts that Keir Starmer may be presenting. Or Rishi Sunak, dare I say, public schoolboy. What we should be thinking about is what's Rishi Sunak saying. And I think Starmer and Sunak could be a little bit more in the moment in terms of what's just been said by that person. Can I use that, yes and way, to move my story forward? And also, I don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but the improv, the yes and notion of I'm really here, I'm able to adapt my thinking. I might change my point of view. If you felt that politicians could do that, I think we'd warm to them. Not that they'd kind of be blowing in the wind, but kind of when you do see a politician say, I didn't know how difficult it was in this instance. I've been to this centre. I've been to this place in the world, in the country, and I thought, that's changed. I didn't realise the effects of government policy. That, to me, is the broader yes and. Acknowledging the facts and empathising. And I dare say on canvassing, they should be yes anding, which is really listening, acknowledging. It's a very easy thing, for example, when you're selling something, to use some of the words used by your would-be customer. I think politicians could do that. Instead of saying, I'm very clear about my XYZ script, somebody said, I'm having trouble getting food. And you say, I understand food is so important for your family. You have to get food on the table. We know if inflation is going up. So try and use their point of view. That's the yes, if you like. And then mm-hmm. and try to move it forward of how we could do something about it. And that must be terribly worrying for you. You want nothing more than to make sure your children are fed. That's the and, if you like, I suppose. So I think there should be better listeners, because people say improv is about thinking on your feet. Actually, it's listening on your feet. It's less acting, more reacting. And while we want politicians to have a few clear, authentic values, I think if they're seen to be listening and responding to what's actually being said to them, we would trust them a bit more.
That's an incredible perspective. And I assume that there's a very fine line between reacting and being prepared to have your mind changed, and ending up in the territory where your critics or your opponents are saying, oh, look at you, you're just flip-flopping. You know, you don't know, we can't really rely on you because you just change your mind all the time. How does somebody in the public eye, it could be in business, but let's say here in politics, how do you straddle those two situations where you want to come across as flexible, receptive, as you say, a great listener? All human beings, they just fundamentally want to feel heard and safe. How can you present that as a politician without the jibe? We don't know what you stand for. You're just, yeah, a flip-flopper.
Well, I think, first of all, stand for something fairly simple so that doesn't move. you can say, right now it's difficult. We really believe that the economy is the important thing, and so forth. rather than saying, oh, yeah, OK, we'll reduce taxes right now. And I would also say that you're talking about gaslighting. I imagine all of these politicians are listening very clearly to focus groups. And that's why they might be seen as flip floppers, because what's in the news this week? Right. I'll talk about that. So I think the difficult thing is to have a simple set of values and targets or objectives. And that's perhaps where it's not entirely clear where the parties stand, because it's so mixed up right now because of the economy and coming out of the pandemic. So I don't think you change your basic values. I think you might say, this is where we stand on this, and I know it's going to be difficult. This is where we stand on this, and we haven't got to it yet. If you see what I mean. So I don't think you're saying, oh, right, we're making up policy on the fly. However, I think part of their job is to defend their policies in the terms that people understand. So I talk about the idea of an offer. What somebody says a word or a concept, try and reply in their frame of reference rather than saying we're very clear on this policy, it's really working. And somebody says, well, for me, it hasn't been working in my hospital, in my job. And you don't negate their experience. You say, I'm sorry to hear that. I don't know. I mean, could they say, I've seen these facts. I've seen this in this other hospital. I'm aware of your situation or situations like it. So accepting their offer, don't try and negate their realities, but sticking to not too many, but quite clear objectives, purpose, the why rather than the what.
And I think you're zoning in on something which is really important, which is the solidity of those values and how safe that makes people feel. And my concern with both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer coming up coincidentally with five pillars, you might say, of things that need to be addressed, is that actually that's almost too many. Five is too many. Three would be perfect. Three, you know, in when you give a speech and you think of three examples of something, it's just a solid way of anchoring the things that you think about. And also because at the moment, there are fewer things that people are concerned about. The things they're really concerned about, like the cost of living crisis, trumps pretty much everything else. You are not going to get people going into the polling booth saying, my mortgage has tripled, my energy bills have escalated, but I'm so glad that there are now fewer boats. It's just hitting too few people, that particular policy. So go back to your basic principles rather than trying to be all things to all men.
I think you're right. And three is a good number. In fact, I teach people how to do speeches, how to be rehearsed, really structured. And of course, they're surprised. I say, no, when you're doing a speech, you've got to be totally structured. And I say, have 3 points, basically, beginning, middle and end. Whenever you can, have an ABC, it's called a tricolon, where you have that shade, you know, red, white and blue, education, education, education. And I follow a lot of presentation coaches on Twitter, and I saw one who said, three's too many, just go for one. And I think that's right. Actually, when you ask people who know about politics, they'll tend to say, do we like the leader? Do we trust him or her on the economy? And it's the economy, stupid, I think was Bill Clinton's phrase. And that probably, and Hal Wilson, the pound in your pocket, that kind of thing, that probably is the whole thing. We will make the economy work. Now, that's difficult because the economy working is different for somebody in this particular area or this income doing this job compared with that person over there with another type of job or technical awareness. It's going to be different for different people. That's why tax is so emotive. I think the boats issue is because it's been made to be somehow that is affecting the economy. That it's on the other hand, if you do any research into what those people who come to this country, eventually they actually are a net benefit to the economy. You know, the financial output is they pay tax, they earn more than they take away, if you like. So and also right now we're desperate for people in certain areas, in care homes, teachers, and doctors. And this is the bizarre thing to me, is that nobody seems to have got to grips with hang on a minute, we're restricting the number of people who can train to be doctors, but there's a big gap of doctors in the NHS. And I just don't know. And I'm also looking at the education sector. My daughter is about to go to university. Has anyone really understood the supply chain of education? I.e., do we know how many people are going in, and are they coming out with the right sort of skills that the economy needs or the society needs? And doctors seems a very obvious one, that we don't seem to have enough doctors. My local GP surgery has a physician associate, for example. What a clever idea. That was really yes-anding, listening. We don't want to have to wait 10 days, 10 weeks to see a doctor. Could we have somebody who's not called a doctor, but they can understand when I say there's something wrong with my knee? And that seems to be a clever use of resources.
But also that came out, I think, a lot during the pandemic had to change so dramatically that what was proven was that actually people could be adaptable. The NHS could be very nimble on its feet and scale up vaccination rollouts or shift GP consultations online. That actually when the chips were down, actually people did discover a spontaneity or a flexibility that perhaps they didn't know they possessed, and organisations discovered that within themselves. And maybe that's something that politicians are ignoring at their peril, that actually there's a lot more scope to be radical and to think outside the box, which again is what I've often seen you demonstrate in improvisation, is this thing that this scene never existed before. It's not like we're doing another play by Chekhov and here's the script and we're just doing it slightly differently. The improvised scene never existed before, and yet we're making something, we're creating something brand new and confident and valid. And I'm just wondering if politicians could learn from that.
I think they could. This is the curious thing, is that actually when we do an improv scene, we are making it up in the moment, but we've had 30 years of experience doing it, and we bring that to bear. And we are also aware that we're trying to pick up the thread from the other person. We're trying to use what the audience give us. So it is a very co-creative, collaborative environment. Politicians, yes, I think if they go back to, I suppose, what we all believe in, which is basically we want a roof over our head and to be able to eat and say, be safe. I guess those are the things that we want. They're the basic things. But the improv bit is, what does safe look like now with cybersecurity, social media and so forth? And without naming the organization, there was somebody who kind of a few months into the pandemic said there may be a verb called, before they realized that many people would die and have long COVID, you know, coronad, we've coronad it, which is what happened in 3 weeks or in 3 months, actually, without this terrible pandemic, might not have happened in 3 years. Very quickly, we adapted to understand that we could use Zoom and Teams, that things were able to be delivered in a different way. And so that was obviously a part of how the new normal is unfolding, is that we don't have to go to work. We can be at home and look after our pets, and we don't have to wear socks because we're on Teams or Zoom. So there's something about the changing lifestyle. On the other hand, I read somebody the other day who had to leave their tennis club because the tennis club doesn't take cash anymore. So who's getting left behind? My mum can do FaceTime, but we struggle with Zoom. So the future surely does lie in a more technically digital cyber world. And let's try and use that as a positive. Of course, only this week, a lot of people said the dangers of AI are as bad as a possible pandemic as well, because AI uncontrolled, artificial intelligence, could be a threat to humanity. So again, we've got to improvise, which is, it's great for this, because I use AI when my phone comes up with predictive text is AI. On the other hand, I don't want it noticing that I've got a cold and therefore I must, die or something like, what was that thing, Soylent Green or Logan's Run, where, suddenly health is, you don't even know, who knows what your health is. I touch the fridge door, somebody in my insurance company suddenly says, oh, we can't insure him for any more unless, give him a 10 million premium. So that's the scary part of artificial intelligence. And I think politicians have to be aware of this. But I think, to go back to my point earlier, there's a bit of creating new, but there's also relying on experience. Who's got the experience we can trust here? Is it the civil servants? Is it the people in the professions like hospitals and teaching? I don't know. I think we have to acknowledge ancient wisdom, ancient or 20-year-old wisdom versus the new world. With ChatGPT, how are we going to help children learn? Do they have to learn anything anymore when you can Google it virtually? But my favorite story is somebody, a friend of mine, who, because I grew up with A to Zs and maps. she didn't. So she just passed the driving test, put in the sat-nav Westfield, which is a big shopping center, except there are two of them. That's one's right. In Shepherd's Bush in the west of London, and one's in Stratford in the east of London. So she just put it in and put Westfield in, and off she goes to Stratford, which is near the Olympic Park. And she was hoping to go to Shepherd's Bush, which is near the old BBC building. And that's a long way off. That's the danger. We rely too much on this. And I think politicians have to be really, really on top of this. We can't any longer say that it isn't an issue. But how do we have our basic values as politicians? And I think Conservative and Labour would say they have basic values. But how does that work when you've got ChatGPT, when you've got SatNav, when you've got Zoom and Teams, when certain jobs may be disappearing, but certain jobs are appearing? How do we stay at the forefront of technological advance, where Britain should be, because we've done a lot of inventing stuff, and we're pretty keyed in, but not as much as many of the other countries in the world?
Well, it reminds me of a lot of relationship skill advice and life coaching advice that I give people, whereby I do use that analogy of the sat nav, whereby you do put in your destination. I want to be in a, you know, I want to be in a loving relationship. I want to be in a fulfilling career or whatever it might be. That's your destination. That's what you put into the sat nav. But you yourself do still have to turn the car on. You do still have to, but you know, if it's a manual car, you have to use the gears and steer the steering wheel. There has to be a balance between the tech and the human input. And therefore, my final question really to you is, I suppose, about the human side, that human input. I've always felt that in order to engage with any audience, whether you're giving a presentation, whether you're pitching to have a pay rise, whether you're on the hustings, you need to connect not just with someone's head, but with their heart, and no more so the audience being, I guess, voters. You want to really connect with their heart and what their dreams are. And I was just wondering, what could things like your book In the Moment, what could improv and preparedness, what could that teach maybe Sunak and Starmer about engaging with an audience?
Well, I've got one chapter called Human Connection, how important it is to connect one another, exactly as you say, with emotions. And we can still do that on Zoom. We can do that on Teams. Again, listening is really where it all starts, and listening and adapting. You, if SatNav says take the turn right, then turn right. On the other hand, I've also got a chapter called Storytelling. And I think we want a politician to tell us the story of who we are and where we're going. And that's obviously also useful in pitching. But how much, I say there are three types of stories we can tell one another. If you're pitching, or if you're a politician, you say, this is how we got here. One story, the past. This is where we are now, making sense of where we are now. And then the next one is really the story of where we're going to go. Are we going to be the sort of society that feels like one? Are we going to be polarized? Am I going to be able to achieve what I'd like? Will I be safe and secure in my job and my house and on the street? So storytelling is the main thing that politicians, and they know they have to do this. They're trying to tell the story of themselves. And we warm to a story of somebody who's overcome barriers. And both the leaders right now will tell us the barriers they and their families have overcome. On the other hand, I don't think either of them has quite told us the story of where Britain is and is going to be. we can't any longer imagine we're the Britain of World War II standing against Hitler, or, you know, with empire and stuff. We are where we are. We're not as big as we used to be. And we need to understand what that story means and to give ourselves a realistic understanding whilst also aspiring to something positive of what we as a society could do. And we as individuals will be valued, and our teams, how do we, my family, my organization, my part of the country, how can we still be involved? And that's, I think, where perhaps, you know, people talk about the red wall and the cities and the towns and stuff like that, is what's the story the politicians are telling us that are going to make us think, yeah, I'm going to trust myself, ourselves, to her or him?
Because that would be the ultimate connection with the ordinary person in the street, because that's how they operate. We're always telling ourselves stories about ourselves, about each other. It's how we communicate about ideas or experiences or beliefs or suggestions. Even just the idea that you and I were chatting about your color-coded bookshelves, which clearly has affected me or disturbed me on a very deep level. But the idea that we share those stories about ourselves, if we're doing that on an individual level, why would our leaders not try to communicate and connect with us in exactly the same way? The best presentations are often given by people who say, I want to tell you a story. I want to set the scene. And that perhaps is the ultimate goal for any leader, any politician.
I think so. But also, stories have been around even since before PowerPoint and Excel spreadsheets, I believe, even before really? Books. Well, and there are Indonesian cave paintings, which before words, stories. And stories, yeah. One thing leads to another. And because of this, something else happens. But also, people make stories up to fit the facts. And this is the our politicians, we've got stories about them that may not be true, but have become popular in our minds. They may be a skewed version of the truth, but until they can tell us a story of what we're going to do and how we can survive and thrive, I think it isn't going to be a very exciting period for us. I think you look back at some of the leaders in the past, they have told us a story. But the danger is that people will make up the story to fit the gap. There's never not a story there, which is, oh, he's a bit of a charlatan. Oh, he's quite a nice guy, but a bit dull. Oh, she was out of her depth. She really believed what she did, and she overcame the forces, as it were. And you can perhaps guess about who I'm talking, but all of those stories may or may not be true, but unless they can be articulated and become viral, we won't believe them. But the stories around at the moment are basically politicians are a bit sleazy. They're not really working for us. On the other hand, you know, there have been there's a handful who've been proven to be corrupt, selling their time and energy. On the other hand, there are a load of politicians, and I have to say this, who you think, I wouldn't want to do that. You're working a lot of hours, putting yourself in line for being slagged off, and you could have chosen to go and do another job. And we see some politicians now saying, actually, I don't want to do it. I don't want my children to be attacked like this. And daddy, you know, they hear stories in the schoolyard about your daddy's horrid. And he may say, well, I'm doing my best. So I think we need to create a story, A, for politics, why politics matters, and why do only 60% of us vote? The story for where we might go next. Politicians need to be aware of the stories people are telling about them, which they are probably from focus groups, and they're probably not very nice stories. They think, that's not fair, that's not me.
But ultimately, they also ought to buy your book, because it will improve their communication exactly. In the moment.
Exactly. It's called In the Moment. And so I talk about how I've taught improv now for quarter of a century to business people in public sector and private sector, by the way, individually, but also when those moments you have to prepare. The worst thing is to try and improvise in a moment when you should have prepared. This is what I say. The Comedy Store Players, we perform every Sunday. We ask the audience for suggestions, but behind that, the Comedy Store has sold tickets, got insurance, security. They've sorted out the food and the drinks. They pay the bills. And so there's a lot of prep for us to be in the moment. And that's where I get people to think, really, is this a moment to be prepared? Is this a moment to work with what's emerging? And those can happen in your day job. You know, they vary minute by minute, actually.
Rather like this podcast. Neil Malarkey, comedian, actor, writer, and yes, author of the brand new book, In the Moment. Thank you very much for being my guest on the couch.
Thank you very much.